Today on Off Mic, the issue of immigration is part of this presidential campaign, and it comes front and center today in Northwest Indiana. Hundreds of undocumented immigrants are flown out of the Gary Chicago International Airport every week. We talked to one activist who has been trying to stop it for years. We also talked to the author of a book about Latino Republicans. All this on Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. The issue of immigration is, of course, part of this presidential election, but it's not some issue that doesn't affect Northwest Indiana. The Gary Chicago International Airport is used by ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to fly undocumented immigrants out of the United States, usually to border cities in Mexico or to Honduras. Ruth Needleman is a retired professor at Indiana University Northwest. She's at the Gary Airport this morning with other demonstrators to speak out against the deportations. Ruth, this has been an issue that's been ongoing, these deportations from the Gary Chicago Airport. How long has this been going on?
Well, as of April of 2017, which was a FOIA request, it said that 2,900 people had already been deported from the Gary Airport. I believe it began in 2014, and then it increased when Trump took over. And they deport people from four states, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, and Kentucky. Now, it used to be two huge white buses. Now there's usually a line of vans. It's either because of the COVID-19, they don't want people in a big bus, but sometimes there's a big school bus. Today, there were about five vans that drove by, and they used to take them to Brownsville. The plane comes from Brownsville, but it returns to Louisiana, and in most cases goes on to Honduras, the most dangerous country in the world.
Wow, wow. And go ahead.
I had been going out. We stopped doing the protests because they brought in the tax squad. They brought in all these armed militia kinds of police, and we couldn't see anything. But recently I decided with another person, Elizabeth Palacio, Mexican, to come out and just do a Greta Thunberg. Just stand witness to this horrible thing that goes on every week. But there was so much harassment and such an effort to prevent us from seeing anything. And I mean anything. They bring in 3 to 4 tankers to block one side. They bring in small planes from the tarmac to block another side. And they use the bus and vans to block completely. So it's a 360-degree blockade, so that we can see what's going on. And it was first rumored that there might have been children. And so I got a professional photographer with a big lens, and we found a spot where you could actually get a picture of the whole tarmac. And we figured out it was mainly Central American. It was very small men going on the airplane. But they pack food in the airplane, which they never did before because they went to Brownsville. And that also was suspicious because they never fed the immigrants before. But we do think that it's mainly Central Americans. The plane comes every week, lands at 10:30 more or less. I now have a tracker, so I know when the plane is going to land. And I know more or less when the vans and bus is going to arrive. And the conditions are horrible. I mean, COVID-19 is so widespread in the detention centers, and there's been so little done to protect the health of these immigrants. They're basically a caged population who have never committed any criminal offense other than not having citizenship papers.
What role? I mean, what do you think the city of Gary can do to pressure the Gary Chicago International Airport to end these deportation flights?
I don't think the city wants to, because even though they say they get nothing in return, most of the money goes to the Jet Center. The Gary Jet Center is privately held by former military colonel, I think, Will Davis. He has made so much money off his ICE contract that he has built three new hangars and office buildings. And some revenue probably comes back. And the current administration thinks that the making money is the only thing that matters for Gary, not health and safety, not protection of the residents, nothing like that. They have a cop sitting out here every week telling me I'm breaking the law. And we have a welcoming city ordinance that says they can't work for ICE or the Jet Center to protect deportations, but they do. I will be meeting with the mayor in 2 weeks because I will not allow this harassment to continue. And we want to bring it out in public. What are they hiding that they make such an effort to make sure that nobody can see what's happening? It's very suspicious and angering, and the cruelty of how they do this is intolerable.
You know, the city of Gary has said in the past that since they receive federal funds, that it cannot deny another federal agency from using the airport to do this, that they can also do it out of O'Hare and Midway if they wanted to. But do you buy that argument?
Here's the thing. There's a compact. I don't know if I ever sent you a copy, but I can. The compact says that the Gary Chicago International Airport will only serve as a reliever to O'Hare and Midway. And what that has meant is they get passenger service and we get the crap. We get deportations and cargo. And so that's part of the agreement in the compact. I also think that they can't deny, but it's the Jet Center that has the contract with ICE. And that contract, I mean, the Jet Center has made literally millions of dollars off that contract. And that's what we're going after. The city council refuses to go after any business in Gary because they think that development means we should welcome all business no matter what it does to the city. But we are going to go again. I'll speak with the mayor in 2 weeks, and then we will go to the city council again. But I do not believe they will do anything but say it's out of our hands.
And you also say that because Gary is considered a welcoming city, that it should not be allowing these flights to happen.
Well, that could be an argument, but we can't tell the federal government not to use a federal airport. But the problem is the Jet Center. And they shouldn't be doing deportations. We shut down an immigrant prison twice in the city. They wanted to build it right near the airport. And we shut it down twice. And also in Hobart and in three other cities in Indiana where they wanted to build a prison. But we have not been able to make any headway with the deportations.
All right, Ruth Needleman, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you for calling. And we need help in the city of Gary because the city of Gary is in, I mean, the city of Chicago is part of this deportation. And you in Chicago are not just a welcoming city, you're a sanctuary city.
All right, Ruth, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ruth Needleman is a retired professor at Indiana University Northwest, and we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ Chicago. It's estimated that 32 million Latinos will be eligible to vote in the general election. That's the most ever, and it also makes Latinos the largest voting bloc after non-Hispanic whites and more than African Americans. Historically, Latinos have voted with Democrats 70% to 30% for the GOP. But some say Latinos could vote in greater numbers for President Donald Trump. That seems a little odd to some, given Trump's rhetoric against Latinos. To get a better understanding of why Latinos vote Republican, I spoke to Geraldo Cadava, a history professor at Northwestern University near Chicago. He recently wrote the book, The Hispanic Republican. I interviewed Professor Cadava outside Manny's Deli in Chicago recently. My first question to Cadava, why did you write the book?
I wrote the book because I really want people from both parties to take Latinos seriously and as voters and political actors who have serious political ideas.
And part of it is a little bit about, I was going to say, how long did it take you to write, but actually your whole life, since it's a little bit about yourself.
That's right. Yeah, my grandfather is a Hispanic Republican. His name is Geraldo Cadava. He is just like mine, that is. He is Colombian and Panameño and Filipino, and he became a U.S. citizen by joining the U.S. military. And he voted for a Republican for the first time in 1980 when he voted for Ronald Reagan. And at the time, he was working in a silver mine outside of Tucson, Arizona. And Reagan was promising to put more money back into his biweekly paycheck with tax cuts. So he voted for a Republican for the first time for that single issue. But then over the past 40 years, and he's still alive, thankfully, has kind of embraced every position of the Republican Party wholesale. So kind of tracing that process and arguing with him about Latino politics for my whole life is, I'm sure, a big part of why I wrote this book.
Now, early in the book, you talk about how Hispanics in the like early part of the 19th century or 20th century were considered Republican.
Yeah.
Just like African Americans.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, a majority of Hispanics were Republicans until the New Deal, really. And then many Latinos kind of went over to the other side and started voting for Democrats because they thought that Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal kind of helped them get jobs, help put food on the table during tough economic times. African Americans also were Republicans at that time. The time when African Americans and Latinos kind of really parted ways in terms of their electoral behavior was during the 1960s, when Republicans embraced the Southern strategy and when the Republican Party kind of rejected the Civil Rights Bill of 1964. And that's when African Americans really abandoned the Republican Party, and very explicitly Nixon's strategists and the people close to him said that he needed to find the more voters, basically. I mean, because he was losing African-American support, he had to pick up other votes somewhere, and Latinos were his kind of top target.
Now, in your book, you wrote about how Nixon, Reagan, and under the Bush administrations, both George H.W. and definitely under George W. Bush, they had a strategy to reach out to Latinos, and especially George W. Bush.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Under Nixon at first, it was really about patronage politics, and Nixon would, you know, he worked hard to create more federal government jobs for Latinos, but he also, you know, appointed the first Hispanic treasurer of the United States. He created the National Economic Development Agency and appointed Benjamin Fernandez as its head. So he was all about appointments and creating federal government opportunities for Latinos. Reagan was the first Republican president to really try to craft an ideology-based message about what the core characteristics of Latino Republican identity were, and they included things like family values, a hard work ethic, anti-communism, free enterprise, all of these kinds of things. And you know, that was kind of the core of the Republican identity, the Latino Republican identity. And interestingly, you know, Reagan was the one who apparently said to, this is how the story goes, said to the San Antonio advertising executive, Leonel Sosa, when Leonel Sosa was brought on to work on Reagan's Hispanic campaign, he said that, Leonel, you know, you've got the easiest job imaginable because Latinos are Republicans who just don't know it yet. And, you know, Hispanic Republicans still repeat that idea as a kind of pivotal moment when a Republican leader was kind of really reaching out to Latinos.
Did some of those inroads to attract Latinos, did it help the Republican Party?
Yeah, it sure did. I mean, in 1972, Richard Nixon became the first Republican president to win about a third of the Latino vote. And sometimes it's been a little less, sometimes it's been a little more, but that 1972 re-election bid really kind of raised the bar for Republican candidates recruiting Latinos in general, and it's kind of been the same ever since.
Now, President George W. Bush, he had a Latino, or at least one Latino, Latina, in his family.
Yes.
So that he was more sympathetic, and he came from Texas.
Yeah, that's right. His brother Jeb was married to Columba Garnica de Gallo in Austin, Texas, at the Catholic Center there, and she changed her name to Columba Bush. But so that has kind of been one of the beginning of the Latino roots of the Bush family. But George H.W. Bush also made a real effort in 1980 when he ran in the primary campaigns against Ronald Reagan to recruit Latino voters. And he actually sent Jeb down to San Juan, Puerto Rico, which was having its first ever Republican primary in 1980, and had Jeb just kind of camp out there for months before the primary election. And as a result, George H.W. Bush actually won the Puerto Rican primary in 1980.
Let me ask you this. It seems like over the years, that sort of 30% mark, yeah, for Latinos, Latino vote Republican Party, that seems to have been a constant.
Yeah, it's fluctuated very little, you know. I mean, again, sometimes it goes up and down by a little bit, like 26, 27%. But even Donald Trump won 28%. Mitt Romney and John McCain won about that amount. George W. Bush is really the outlier, having won 40 and 44%, but, you know, he was the outlier, really.
What was it about George W. Bush that Hispanics seemed to gravitate to?
Well, I think there are a couple things. First, as I was talking about with Jeb Bush and George H.W. Bush, there had been this kind of long-standing family tradition of cozying up to Latino communities in Puerto Rico and Florida and Texas and California, elsewhere. So when George H.W. Bush ran for president in 1980 and 1988, he would send Jeb on, campaign tours. He would go give speeches in Texas, California, all over the place. And this was part of the Bush family forming relationships with Latino communities. So I think George W. Bush had that going for him. He was also the governor of a border state, and in the 1990s had a much more kind of moderate stance on immigration and border issues than the Republican Party in general. I think it's important to remember in the 1990s that, you know, you have Pat Buchanan giving George H.W. Bush a serious primary challenge in 1992, and he was kind of running kind of as a xenophobe, someone who actually wanted to construct a border wall between the United States and Mexico. Then there was Proposition 187 in California, and then the Restrictive Immigration Bill in 1996. So the Republican Party took a really hard right turn on immigration in the 1990s. So George W. Bush really kind of pulled the party back from that brink, and Hispanic Republicans were extremely relieved. So I think it was the combination of his family's connections and the context of kind of pulling the Republican Party back from the brink of its anti-immigrant positions in the 1990s.
Do you think, though, non-Hispanic white Republicans wanted that initiative? Did they welcome it?
You mean the moderate tone, the more moderate tone of the George W. Right. Bush years? That's a great question, man. I mean, I think non-Hispanic white Republicans have always wrestled with how inclusive to be and how much to remain the white conservative party. You know, I think that that's been an amazing deep rift within the Republican Party. So I think many people did and many people didn't. I mean, there were people like Karl Rove who were all for it. There were people like Ralph Reed, the head of the, an evangelical Christian. I can't remember the name of his group. But people like Ralph Reed and Karl Rove were all for kind of making the Republican Party a big tent party that was really inclusive. But then there were other people who weren't. And I still think today you see those kinds of tensions exist within the Republican Party. And I do think the kind of reckoning within the Republican Party about what kind of party to become in the future is going to be one of the really important issues the party has to face.
Let me ask you this before we get too much into the weeds with Trump. Has your, you said your grandfather was Republican, yeah. Even still is today.
Still is.
He ever felt either lonely or odd, or has it put him at a distance with his other family members who are Hispanic?
No, you know, not really. I mean, it's his politics have been something that we've always argued about. And, you know, first of all, I will say that my grandfather was in the military. Then he worked washing dishes in silver mines. I don't know. You know, he was never, like, involved in the Republican Party. He didn't belong to any Republican Party groups or organizations, nothing like that. So his Republican identity wasn't really, like, a social thing for him. It was just what he believed. And the arguments and conversations we had about it were always just within the family, you know. And, you know, I would say that I don't think he felt lonely. I think we were his family and we loved him. We didn't like isolate him or, you know, push him off to a corner when we were talking about politics. We had these conversations with him. We talked about the border. We argued about the border. He always talked about Bill O'Reilly and Lou Dobbs and said, you know, they're really looking out for me. They have my best interests in mind. So he would say things like that and we would kind of shrug it off and be dismissive and laugh and maybe disagree, but you know, He's my grandpa, you know? Yeah, right. I love him.
Do you consider yourself a Republican?
I am not. I'm a Democrat. I've been a Democrat my whole life. But I do think that for, you know, an important part of knowing who Latinos are in general, not just as voters, but as human beings, as a community, I think it's really important to understand who the, you know, third of Latinos who vote for Republicans are. I think that's an important part of understanding Latinos in general.
A lot of white or Anglo folks might say, oh, but what, you know, there are Hispanic Republicans, but what kind of Hispanics? Cubans or Mexicans? It seems, writing from your book, it's just a hodgepodge. It doesn't really matter what your background is. Yeah, generally Cubans from Miami tend to be Republicans, but I'm seeing more Puerto Ricans, Mexicans being Republican too.
Yeah, so I think in a lot of ways, you know, the main idea I was trying to write against was the idea that Latino conservatism can be reduced to Cuban exile identity or Catholics with traditional family values about or ideas about marriage and abortion. You know, that's just not what I found when I started to interview people, when I got into the archives. I found that it was a much more diverse, national, broad movement than that. Yes, it's true that, you know, you can find Cubans in South Florida who vote for Republicans in greater percentages than other Latinos elsewhere. But even to this day, like 25 years after Proposition 187 in California, you're still going to find 23, 24, 25% of Latinos in California where the Republican Party has supposedly been dead for 25 years. About a quarter of Latinos there are going to vote for Donald Trump. So it's really everywhere. It's a diverse movement.
Okay, so then Donald Trump starts, you know, his rhetoric during his campaign, and he's continued that. You definitely describe his tweet about, you know, Mexicans being rapists and coming abroad. That definitely, I mean, I've talked to some Republican Hispanics about this, but that definitely was a racist tweet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I'm not going to sit here and debate whether or not calling Mexicans rapists and criminals and thieves is racist. I mean, I think it's definitely racist. I think that, you know, he would say, I'm not even going to try to justify what he said. It's just racist. And there's no doubt that his administration has kind of borne out some of those ideas. They've had some of the most restrictive immigration policies in modern times. He's also continued to say things about Mexican immigrants as criminals and calling them animals. And it's under his administration where we've seen, you know, kids separated from their family members and families torn apart and migrants placed in detention centers that have poor conditions, those kinds of things. So, you know, what's been amazing to watch with Trump's Latino outreach is they've almost lived in this kind of friction-free fantasy zone where none of that comes up. I mean, he talks a lot about how well Latinos have done economically. You know, they have higher rates of home ownership, higher median incomes, and low rates of unemployment. All of this is before COVID, of course, and they like to, you know, talk a lot about the pre-COVID economy, and I'm always confused about that because it seems like a fiction. There's no such thing as the pre-COVID economy anymore because it's really just about moving forward and who's going to get us back on track, right? So, you know, all of Trump's outreach efforts and the Latinos for Trump campaign have existed in this, you know, friction-free zone of positivity where they haven't really been called to account for the immigration policies.
With that, with a lot of his rhetoric, his statements, are you surprised, though, he's managed to perhaps not even maintain that 30% benchmark for Republicans, but even attract certain Hispanics? Are you surprised about that?
I'm not surprised about that in the slightest. I mean, the writing this book, The Hispanic Republican, has taught me that fairly consistently over the past 50 years, about 30% of Latinos have voted for the Republican Party. So, you know, as a historian, I can say that's a pretty consistent pattern, and there's very little reason. I mean, and I should say that, like, that pattern has continued even through the times that the Republican Party has taken a right turn on immigration. So, you know, as a historian, those patterns lead me to believe that he'll have the same kind of success in 2020. That said, you know, history also teaches you that just because things have been one way for 50 years doesn't mean that they're destined to be that way for the next 50 years. Change can happen anytime. And in some ways, this moment is ripe for change with the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter protests and the economic harm and death caused by the pandemic. So we'll see. But, you know, if I had to guess right now, I would expect that Trump will maintain his support or maybe even grow it a little bit, as you said. I mean, there's no doubt that the Latinos for Trump campaign has made Latinos a critical group of voters over the past few months. In many ways, they are central to Trump's success, and everything is pointing to them continuing that outreach effort. So I think that would be partially responsible for his continued success.
Yeah, but when you say that, continuing that outreach effort, it's almost like the outreach effort by bashing Hispanics?
Right. Well, there's no doubt. Yes, it's a head-scratcher. It's totally a head-scratcher. But this is where they've kind of maintained this consistent drumbeat about the economy, about defending religious freedom, about Trump being the leader who's going to stand up to leftist leaders in Latin America. Those are the messages that are getting across, and they would say that all of the other things you're hearing about, like the boycott Goya, or like take for example the kids in cages and separation of families, what they argue there is that that was a policy initiated during the Obama years, and of course the scale wasn't as much, the conditions weren't as bad. Nevertheless, that's not important. You know, it's an answer to the challenge. And so in many ways, his supporters, and they say this over and over, right? Like, immigration and the border rank comparatively low on their list of priorities compared with jobs, education, healthcare. And on those issues that they say they care more about compared with immigration, there are conservative positions like school choice, like anti-abortion, like financial deregulation and tax cuts that there is a percentage of Latinos who are motivated by.
How did your grandfather square all this? How did, when you talk to him, do you talk to him still about all this?
Yeah, of course.
About the separation of children, all this other rhetoric stuff.
So no, I don't still talk to him at this point. Honestly, he's 95, living in a VA home.
He's not changing.
He's not changing, but he also, you know, these days I talk to him about the movies he's watching. You know, we don't get into kind of political arguments anymore, but...
But you used to.
We used to, no doubt. I mean, in the 90s into the 2000s, we would talk about these things because, you know, the 2000s, for example, I wrote my first book about the Arizona-Sonora border, and I went out to Tucson for a year to do my dissertation research in 2006 and 2007. This is when Congress was debating things like the Secure Fence Act and the McCain-Kennedy bill, all these, you know, punitive immigration reforms that would lead to the construction of border walls along the Arizona border, these things. So I was really talking to my grandpa then about border politics, and he would just say the same thing that many Latino conservatives say today, which is, I came legally, I did it the right way, I'm not against immigration, I'm just against illegal immigration. That's what they say. And I would try to argue with him about, like, but Grandpa, you don't understand. It's not as easy as just, like, studying for the citizenship test and taking it and becoming a citizen. People wait 20, 30 years for this. I remember thinking about this line when Melania Trump gave her speech at the Republican National Convention this year, because she said, like, I studied hard for the citizenship test and I became a citizen. I was like, well, that sounds so easy. You make it sound so easy, you know?
Yeah, that's all you need to do.
It's all you got to do. Just study a little bit, take the test, and you're good, you know? So those are the kinds of things he would say. And I just think that it's a matter of emphasis and the issues that certain groups prioritize. And here's the thing I would warn against. I would just warn against seeing Latino Republican support for Trump as some kind of, like, false consciousness or some sort of
self-hatred,
self-loathing, selling out, some sort of betrayal of your race. I just don't believe that Latino conservatives see themselves this way. No one I interviewed said, like, oh, I'm a sellout. I'm a race traitor. I am, acting against my own interests. It's just that I think that everyone has a very different view of what their own interests are, you know? So in that sense, yeah, you know, maybe Latino conservatives tend to be the ones who earn more. Maybe they have lighter skin. Maybe they're business owners, so they're into financial deregulations. All of those things. But none of that is a matter of, like, false consciousness. It's just a different set of interests. And I think that that's why it's important to take them seriously, because you can't just dismiss individuals who have sincerely held beliefs. You can disagree with them. I think you should disagree with them, and you should argue with them about things like school choice or policy toward Latin America or whether the tax cut actually benefits Latinos broadly, those kinds of things. I think you should have those serious, reasoned debates about policy, but don't dismiss them as sellouts or race traitors. It doesn't get us anywhere in terms of understanding who Latinos are.
I think it's safe to assume that Latinos as a group will never vote as a huge one-sided voting bloc for either party.
Never. But I think it's been assumed that they would. I think it's always assumed that Latinos are natural Democrats. I mean, I guess both parties have made the argument that Latinos are naturally one way or the other. They're either naturally conservative because of family values, abortion, whatever, or they're naturally liberal because, you know, they have been discriminated against in the United States. They've been, you know, subjected to all kinds of economic and social inequalities, those kinds of things. And those kinds of ideas are behind statements that Latinos are natural Democrats or natural conservatives. But I don't think Latinos or anyone are naturally anything. I don't think you're born as a Democrat or a Republican. I think your partisan identity, your political beliefs, they're a product of, you know, where you grew up, your family relationships, what your sense of right and wrong in the world is. And I think that's how political identity develops. And I think that, to your point, yes, I think that Latinos are going to remain a kind of diverse voting group, just like they should be. I mean, in some ways, they're Americans, just like all other Americans. Why can't Latinos have complicated, contradictory ideas, just like every other group?
Right. And with that, even though it's about 30%, but there's enough of the Latinos out there that even if it switches by 2 or 3%, either way, that could mean a lot in terms of the outcome of an election, especially in swing states where you don't think. I'm not really sure what the population, Hispanic population is in Wisconsin, Michigan, or Florida. We know it's bigger.
Yeah.
But 1 or 2 points can sway that election outcome.
I looked up just a few days ago. I looked up what the 10 states were with the slimmest margin of victory in 2016. Either way, right? So they were, of course, states like Florida, Arizona, where we know there are a lot of Latinos, but those states also included Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, and Maine. So I looked that up, and then I went and looked up what the Latino population in those states are, the Latino voting population more particularly, and in every single case except for Maine, the number of Latinos living in those states was larger voting Latinos was larger than the margin of victory in 2016. So, you know, all it takes is a break in one direction or another. Just take Florida for one example, a state we hear a lot about. Trump's margin of victory in 2016 was 110,000 votes. There are something like 3.1 million Latinos in the state. I can't remember if that's the population or the voting population. The point is, there are tens of times, like, you know, factors and exponentially more Latinos in the state than the number of votes that Trump won by. And that's why, you know, places like Miami-Dade, but also Tampa and Central Florida are going to be super hard fought, because movements, you know, of 5, 10, 15,000 voters really make a difference.
Just in the future, what if Trump wins this re-election, do you only see Hispanic support for Republicans just maybe going to be breaking that 30% mark?
I think here's the issue. The way the demographics are changing in the United States, we know now that Latinos are about 18% of the American population. That number is going to rise maybe to 30% by the year 2040, maybe 35-40% by the year 2050. You know, so the population is growing, and the Latino population is one of the fastest growing communities in the United States. This year, for the very first time in 2020, Latinos are the second largest block of voters, only behind non-Hispanic whites. For the first time, there are more Latino voters than African-American voters. There will be 1 million new Latino voters in 2020. So you get the picture. The picture is that the Latino population is growing and the Latino electorate is growing. So I just don't think that it's going to be a winning strategy well into the future for Republicans to continue to win only 30% of the Latino vote. Winning 30% of anything is never like a long-term recipe for success, you know? So they're going to have to figure out how to grow their Latino base. And I think there are some evidence now that they're already getting there, you know? In a lot of the conversations I've been having with Hispanic Republicans, it's actually the older Hispanic Republicans, those who came into the Republican Party during years that they considered to be more inclusive, like during the Nixon years, the Reagan years, the Bush years. They are the Hispanic Republicans who are most wrestling now with their continued support for the Republican Party. It's the older Hispanic Republicans who are questioning whether they can continue to support Republicans given the shifts within the party. It's actually not the younger Latinos. They don't know a different Republican Party. The Republican Party they know is Trump's Republican Party, and they are, you know, I'm not going to say that they're eating it up, because there's all kinds of evidence that Latino youth are more progressive, they skew more liberal than older Latinos, and that's true, but you know, it's kind of been surprising that there has been some appetite for Trump's message among Latino youth.
And they don't see it as racist.
Well, I don't know that they don't see it as racist. I mean, I don't think they love it. You know, you'll hear Latino Republicans of all ages say over and over, like, I don't like how he talks. I wish he would kind of moderate his tone. But I like some of his policies. I like that he supports free enterprise. I like that he supports economic growth. I like that he wants to create jobs, those kinds of things. I like that he supports school choice. I mean, a third of all students in charter schools are Latinos. And I think that that's why Biden and Democrats have to come up with responses directly to Trump's positions on education and religious freedom, things like that. They have to engage those issues directly. I don't think it's going to be enough for Biden to just say, look at what this guy has done on immigration and the border. He's thrown kids in cages. As shocking and as horrible that is, I don't think that that's going to be the thing that's going to increase Biden's support.
Gerardo Cadava is a history professor at Northwestern University. He's the author of the book, The Hispanic Republican. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Historically, Latinos vote with Democrats 70% of the time. Many Democratic Latinos wouldn't dare to vote for President Trump due to his perceived rhetoric against Latinos. But many Latino Republicans don't see it that way at all. Nelson Velasquez is a big-time Trump supporter. I caught up with him recently over coffee at the Starbucks just across the border in Calumet City, Illinois.
Where did you grow up, Nelson? We're here in Calumet City. You grew up here in Cal City.
That's right. Well, actually, I originally started out of South Chicago, then moved into Dalton, Illinois. So I'm pretty much Dalton. Used to be a former Dalton resident.
And where do you live at now?
Glen Ellyn.
Glen Ellyn. Is that considered DuPage?
That is DuPage County.
All right. And your background is Puerto Rican descent.
Yes, my mom and dad were born in Bayamon, Puerto Rico. I was born here in Chicago, Illinois.
And when did they arrive to the Chicago area?
They arrived in the Chicago area, I want to say back in 1958.
And what did they do when they were here?
Well, my mom was a registered nurse. She graduated from the University of Puerto Rico in nursing. And she took a position in Chicago, Jackson Park Hospital. And my dad was a grocer, so he immediately opened up his own business, what we call Bodega, which is a small Spanish grocery store.
Here in Cal City?
No, that happened near 73rd and Ridgeland, right by Jackson Park Hospital. That's roughly near, not far from 73rd and Stone Allen Avenue.
And did you say your parents also ran like a Puerto Rican nightclub?
My dad owned Angel's Nightclub, which was the first Puerto Rican nightclub in the South Chicago area.
And there they had live music and DJs?
Yeah, live music, salsa, and things of during the Hector Lavoe era.
You ever get Tito Puente to play there?
No, I don't know if Tito Puente ever played there, but I'm sure he came through East Chicago quite a bit. Yeah. You never know if he made a stop there. Just never know.
Well, I know he played in my hometown, East Chicago. They had a lakefront festival a couple of times he stopped by. Well, let me ask you this. You had described yourself growing up as a Democrat.
That is correct. I was a diehard Kennedy-style Democrat. I was a believer in what Kennedy said, you know, ask not what your country could do for you, but what you can do for your country. And I still stand by that.
What changed for you? When did you start making the transition to becoming a Republican? And what changed for you? What happened?
And I don't even know if I can really consider myself a Republican. I am moderate. I'm like a hybrid of being moderate and conservative. I still maintain the old Democratic values, which today's standards are now Republican standards, because the standards that I held that were Democrat at one time are no longer the standards that they go by now.
Can you kind of explain it?
Well, for instance, I believe parents, the nuclear family, is the most important element in the family structure. I don't believe teachers and other persons should be taking the place of parents as far as what needs to be taught and things of that nature. You know, when I was a kid, heck, if I was doing something wrong, the officer would bring me home, and my mother would thank the officer and slap the heck out of me. You know, it was just one of them things. You know, it was all about respect.
And now, right now, you consider yourself a supporter of President Trump?
Yes, right now, President Trump is the best candidate for that position. Yes, because although people may say what they say about Trump, but you know what? He's the only one that actually stands for what I believe today.
A lot of people say that he has said disparaging things about Hispanics, Latinos, either in texting or things he actually said. When, like, for example, the first tweet he came out with when he was running about Mexicans A lot of them are rapists. They're not setting their best over here. How did you take a statement like that?
Well, then again, first of all, there are those who oppose Trump who are quick to say that Trump said all Mexicans. See, for some reason, they interject the word all, which is so untrue. And what he said was Mexico is not sending their best. That's a fact. Most of the people that come that are in this caravan, the right, well, they're not their scientists, they're not their business owners. You know, it is people who unfortunately don't have much means, and at the same time, yes, the criminal element is leaving Mexico, and yes, Mexico doesn't have a problem with those individuals leaving, and to me, that's what Trump was referring to.
How did you feel he handled, say, the hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico? Some people say he didn't do enough. He was very disparaging. How do you see it?
See, I'm about contacts, not emotions. Number one, Trump is a businessman. He's running his country like a business. Unlike our previous presidents who ran his country like a politician. As far as, you know, Trump had mentioned, hey, why throw a lot of money at a government that's corrupt? They're not spending it correctly. And he's been spot on. You have individuals in Puerto Rico who say the same thing. The money never gets to the people who receives it. And he just wanted accountability. In fact, he did release several billion dollars to Puerto Rico to assist them. But at the same time, politicians have been held accountable. In fact, the FBI has made several arrests within the past 6 months due to corruption, the same type of corruption Donald Trump was talking about.
The notion, there's been stories out there recently that suggest Democrats have taken it or have forgotten about Hispanics or taken that vote for granted. How do you see? Do you see more Latinos gravitating to becoming a Republican or supporting Trump? How's it been for you, the transition, especially now?
That's a good question, because most Latinos who do not think with their emotional side, they think about their pocketbook issues, what affects their families, their taxes, their property taxes, crime in the area. I am one of those individuals, and there is a slew more of Latinos who feel just like I do. That's why you have so many different Latino for Trump organizations. They're out there. Now, unfortunately, due to the attitude of the left, Democrats that are into shaming people for what they believe, well, it is what it is. People don't want to lose friends, and they have. So rather than tell their friends, hey, guess what? I'm a Trump supporter. No, they say, you know what? I'm not saying anything. I'll let my vote do the talking. That's the reason why you saw the effects of 2016. People are tired of being shamed and who to vote for. We are not cattle. We are people. We are single-minded, thought-thinking individuals. We are not the masses. I don't need to vote for a particular person just because I'm Hispanic. Anybody who would tell me that, I look at them and I'd say, you know what? You need to dig a little deeper and be a better representative of your people.
You're talking about politics can be very polarizing right now. And you even said, you know, a lot of people maybe not come out and say they support Trump. Just sort of, I'm not saying anything. Is it for the, and I know you're not speaking for all Latinos, but just in your experience, can supporting Trump as a Latino sort of be, for lack of a better term, sort of a lonely place?
Yes and no. I mean, when you say lonely, I think of in single numbers, and I know there's a lot of us out there. There's a lot of us out there, just like there's a lot of Latinos who are against Trump. But it's fascinating. You know, all you have to do is ask an individual, what is it about Trump you don't like? And I'm amazed at how many times very rarely do they ever mention his policies. They talk about he's a homophobic, he does not like Hispanics, he's a racist. And you know what? If you look at things that Donald Trump has had, none of that can be proven. I mean, he's had so many, well, he still does have African-American friends, sports celebrities, Latin athletes. Everybody used to support Donald Trump prior to him becoming president, especially the ones who claim he's racist. They used to be friends of his. Hillary Clinton was at a wedding with him. I mean, really, do you normally go to weddings of where the racist is there and you actually accept donations from a racist? This is all politics, and it's shameful. It's actually a destruction of the core of our nation, of what's going on.
The only reason I say the term lonely is because when you do go to like more rallies, either if it's a Democratic rally, you usually see a little bit more diversity. When you go to a Trump one, maybe less, and you almost could point out the Latinos who might be there. Have you been to an exclusively, say, Latino for Trump rally? Does that happen around here?
Well, I haven't been to any of Trump's rally, to be honest with you. Now, I do know that, you know, if I were to go to, let's say, Texas or these other areas where they have Latino for Trump organizations, if I were to, I can go to those if I like, but I'm a busy individual. I don't take politics to bed with me, nor is it a function of mine when I operate daily. It's just something that I speak of when asked about, but I don't make it part of my life.
If you were talking to a group or Latinos, young people, whatever, what would you tell them? I know you're not a salesman, but if you had to tell them, look, these are the points as to why I support Donald Trump, and not that you're going to sell it to them, but like, this is why you should support him, or this is why, these are some of the factors you should consider.
Okay. Well, what I would tell a Latino is that, number one, you're a person. Politics was nowhere around when you were born. Politicians don't put money in your pocket, okay? You choose based on what is best for you and your family. Don't ever let anybody tell you vote for a particular party because you're Latino. That's ridiculous. In fact, African Americans are going through this right now where they'll call their fellow person Uncle Tom. Why? Because they have their own thought process. That's shameful. It's very ignorant. And I tell my brother Latinos, don't be ignorant. You know, if you feel strongly about something, be able to talk about it. You know, be able to discuss it. Be able to describe it is what you're looking for in a president. I mean, just because a person didn't grow up according to your guidelines, it's got nothing. It's all about pocketbook issues. Your kids, their kids. You know, that's what it's about. It's you and your family, and what politician represents the better interest of your family.
And that was Nelson Velasquez talking about his support for President Trump. And that is all the time we have for today's Off Mic. I'd like to thank my producers, Dee Dotson, Tom Maloney, Jose Rodriguez, and my student intern from Calumet College of St. Joseph, Emily Gomez. For Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Michael Puente. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.